However, as I show in the book, there's no evidence that radio corporations routinely coordinate their behavior. Here's the diffusion curve across top 40 stations of Umbrella, but this time it's broken out by radio company. And as you can see, the curves are basically the same for each company. And that's not what you'd expect if decisions were made centrally at corporate headquarters. So basically, corporate radio's off the hook, but we still have a whodunit for what is coordinating radio. Well, here's a good candidate for what could be coordinating radio. This is an invoice from somebody at Atlantic Records showing gifts bought for radio stations in order to promote various artists on that record label. Typically, the gifts are worth a few hundred dollars, and the station passes them along to listeners. The 10th caller gets concert tickets, that sort of thing. Record labels are very aggressive about promoting singles to radio stations, in much the same way as pharmaceutical companies are in promoting new drugs to doctors. Some types of promotion, like mailing a CD in a press kit, are perfectly and unequivocally legal. Others are gray areas or outright illegal, such as bribing a disc jockey or bribing a radio programmer. This particular document comes from the appendix to a consent decree with the state of New York, so obviously the state of New York felt that this was at the very least suspicious, and the record label thought that it was suspicious enough that they better settle the case rather than fight it. The fundamental model in the sociology of culture comes from a 1972 article by Paul Hirsch. The gatekeeping model treats culture industries as a series of stages, and there's a progressive winnowing as most people fail at each successive stage. You start with the original authors. This could be garage bands with a demo tape, or the guy who has a book manuscript, or an actor who has a headshot and is trying to get into the movie, something like that. Then you have cultural distributors. These are the companies who help put out art. They accept only a fraction of the aspiring authors who approach them. Most bands don't get a record deal. Most authors don't get published. Most aspiring actors don't get cast. From there, you move on to surrogate consumers. These are the folks who publicize or validate culture. Critics, awards, radio stations, etc. Sometimes these people could also be called tastemakers. Again, most work that makes it to this stage fails at this stage. For instance, most books that are published don't get reviewed in the New York Times. Finally, you get to actual consumers. Again, most things that get published and get publicized still don't get to be hits with the consuming public. Now, what Hirsch hit upon was that the key relationship is between cultural distributors and surrogate consumers, the folks who circulate art and the folks who publicize art. And in pop music, this traditionally means record labels and radio stations. Of course, it is possible to overdo the strength of this relationship. Since the radio records business model came to characterize the music industry in the 1950s, there have been four scandals about payola, or music bribery. The details vary considerably. Payola used to involve drugs and the mafia, but more recently it's mostly about things like free concert tickets to give to the 10th caller. You can read about the details of each of these periods in my book, or in the book Hitmen by Frederick Dannen, but I want to emphasize that payola keeps coming back. Or if you want to be less judgmental about it, very aggressive and dubiously legal radio promotion techniques keep coming back. There's a scandal and a prosecution, and then about 15 years later, there'll be another scandal and another prosecution. It's kind of like a cicada for white-collar crime. But we can ask, why would this be? Why would it keep coming back? Why don't they learn the lesson that if you do this, you'll eventually go to prison or get fined or have to sign a consent decree? Well, let's game it out. Consider two record labels seeking airplay. Think about it from the perspective of label one. If label 2 doesn't bribe, then label 1 has a choice. Do I split the airplay and keep my money, or do I pay a small bribe and get all the airplay? Given this choice, label 1 would probably rather pay a little bit of money and get a lot of airplay. They'd rather have the airplay than the money. Now, conversely, let's imagine that label 1 knows that label 2 is going to bribe. If so, it has a choice between saving its money but not getting any airplay whatsoever, or paying a lot of money and splitting the airplay. Under this situation, label 1 would reluctantly rather pay the money and get at least some airplay than pay nothing and not get any airplay. So the interesting thing here is that regardless of what label 2 does, the label 1 is better off paying a bribe. So we can say that bribery is a strictly dominant strategy for label number 1. Now, of course, label 2 faces exactly a parallel set of incentives, so we can also say that bribery is a strictly dominant strategy for label 2. Now, when you have the intersection of these two dominant strategies, you see that at equilibrium, we get both labels paying bribes. And note that the two labels still share airplay equally, just like when neither of them was paying bribes. They just have to pay for it now. So the arms race of promotional expenses ends up putting the record labels in a prisoner's dilemma, where they get nothing more than they could have gotten, and they end up having to pay for it a lot more. Now, as Ronald Coase notes in a 1979 article, This dynamic predates the recorded music industry. You used to actually see it with the sheet music publishers bribing vaudeville acts back when the music industry was based on people buying sheet music that they saw performed on stage. And it's interesting to note, and Coase does note this, that cultural distributor firms would benefit if they could agree not to pay bribes. Indeed, we've seen several attempts at monopsonistic cartels to avoid paying bribes. Coase notes, following Sanjak and Sanjak, that during the vaudeville era, you had this with the Music Publishers Protective Association, and then following Coase's article more recently, in 1986, after there was a scandal involving the mafia, the Recording Industry Association of America voted to stop paying bribes. But the problem is that, like all cartels, these agreements are vulnerable to cheating. And so you get a basic pattern that when publicity is valuable, people end up paying for it one way or another. And so you have the situation where, just as Hirsch expected, the key relationship that characterizes the cultural industries is cultural distributors trying to co-opt the surrogate consumers who effectively control what becomes popular in their industries. That's it. See you.